My name's Michelle O'Woo and I'm carrying out this interview on behalf of the Wellcome Trust for the One Another Project. The date is the 18th of August 2009. The time is 9:14 p.m. Could you tell me your name, your age and where you come from, please?
My name is Ella Kent. I'm 43 and I come from a little village called Weston in Hertfordshire.
How are you feeling?
I feel good. Yeah, I'm very excited and a little nervous, but mostly excited.
Are you staying over tonight or are you going back tonight?
No, I'm going back home because I don't live that far outside of London, so I'm going home, driving home tonight.
And who have you brought along with you tonight?
I brought my husband with me tonight and left all my children and all my friends watching online.
How many kids have you got?
I've got three. And they are 19, 18 and 14. So they're quite grown up.
Can you describe what you're wearing for me, please?
Yes, I'm wearing black linen trousers and a black dress with frills at the front and a cardigan, which is a kind of trademark cardigan because I seem to always wear cardigans with a crew neck, kind of 50s style. My hair's up and that's black as well because I quite like black, and black plimsolls too. I am the lady in black.
Do you often wear black?
I do, yeah, I do a lot actually. I have tried to explore other colours, but it always comes back to black.
Can you remember how you first heard about this project?
I was driving in my car to probably to work, I think, and I heard it on Radio 4. And it just sounded really exciting, so I went into work and logged onto the computer and logged onto the website and registered.
What was it about the project specifically that made you want to take part, do you think?
I just really like the idea of mass performance, but also individual performance. So the idea of having so many people together, but also as individuals as well. So being a part of a collective, but having that space to explore your own individual creativity too. And the fact that it's, that there's a certain amount of danger to it, in that anybody could kind of get up and do anything to a certain extent. I realise that obviously there are certain measures, safety measures put in place, but it was that certain amount of that anybody could kind of do or say anything to a certain extent that I quite liked. And the fact that so many everyday people, for want of a better word, were so excited and wanting to be involved, and I just thought that was fantastic that so many people wanted to get up there and do their thing.
And what are you going to do?
I'm going to bring my performance persona to the plinth, who is called Professor Morticia Catherine, and she is going to deliver her wit and wisdom about snogging and snogisms to whoever would like to listen during her slot, and hopefully try and get whoever is in Trafalgar Square at this lovely evening to take part in a mass kiss at the end.
Have you been working on snogging for a while?
I have been working on snogging for a while, both personally and professionally. I worked with Annie Sprinkle and Beth Stevens on the Blue Wedding project, which is kind of how Professor Morticia Catherine was born. She was something that I brought to the wedding reception of that project, and she went around doing various bits of mouth research to find out how people felt about kissing and what they liked to do with their mouth, and surprisingly people were very open and generous with their comments, and not at all kind of crude and outrageous, which I sort of half expected. I half expected people to be a little bit kind of outrageous with things they said, but people were really honest. And I also did a short piece of installation film based around the mouth and how people felt about their mouths and what they like to do. And I kind of explored that via different mediums, both through film and things like email and text and speaking to people face-to-face, questionnaires. And again, some amazing and very touching responses that people gave about not liking their teeth and not smiling because they didn't like people to see what their teeth looked like and being afraid of having bad breath. And yeah, it was quite surprising the things that people said.
How did you hook up with those people? How did you contact them?
Through a number of different ways. One of the ways that I initially contacted people was via an email. And I sent an email out to people that I knew because I felt that people might be more comfortable answering questions in that way. And most of the most comprehensive answers came back via email, I think because people felt there was a certain amount of anonymity about that, that they, you know, that they were just sending an email and all you could see was their email address, even though we took pictures of the emails that were sent in. And then I actually interviewed some people face to face as well, those people that were willing, and I got some really nice responses, particularly from older women actually, who were, I suppose, perhaps a little bit more comfortable about themselves and about the way they felt about things. And I also set up, in the college where I work performance department, I set up a black box where people could come and chalk their answers on the floor as well, so they could come in and out of the black box and actually put their answers in chalk on the floor again, so there was a certain amount of an anonymous, they could, you know, have some anonymity there. So again, I got various kind of answers, and different answers from guys to girls. People saying, you know, things like, I really like to eat curry, and other people saying, you know, that they were not very confident at kissing and things like that. So that first sort of bit of installation work kind of springboarded some other ideas as well, like exploring the idea of kissing. And And then I went on to do the extreme kiss myself.
Can you tell me more about that?
The extreme kiss was something that took place at the Chelsea Theatre with Annie Sprinkle and Beth Stevens. They initiated the project as part of their Love Art Lab. And they encouraged people to come along and take part in a 3-hour kiss, durational kiss, where people could explore different ways of kissing. And there was very few kind of guidelines, except for, you know, people were not allowed to go beyond kissing. It was just kissing. There was no heavy petting or foreplay or anything like that. Or, you know, people had to explore the parameters of what it was like to kiss in as many different ways as they could for 3 hours. And it was a pretty amazing experience. And for me, it was really it was really eye-opening, because I was never really that much of a fan of kissing. I found it quite... I always kiss my children, always kissed and cuddled my children, but partners wasn't quite so forthcoming. You know, I wasn't so kind of into the kissing side. And this was really... To have to be put in this situation where you... were kind of forced to kiss for 3 hours. I think it really woke something up inside me, I think, and I suddenly realized, yeah, this is actually really good and really exciting, and loads of kind of crazy chemical things happen when you kiss for that long. You know, the endorphins go a bit crazy and you become very euphoric and blissed out, and you explore things about your partner that you're with that perhaps you weren't aware of before. So for me it was a really interesting experience, and it made me want to kind of explore those areas in terms of intimacy, of how I perceive it, and why do I feel like that about, you know, why did I feel like that about kissing? What was it about me, or, you know, that I needed to kind of deal with? And so again, the performance persona that I then kind of developed was a little bit of, you know, she was very much the other side of that. She was very much the person who was the explorer of that, whereas perhaps me, as my normal everyday self, I wouldn't be quite so out there and kind of confident in that, but she is. So I learned kind of lots about the way that people feel about their lips and kissing, and it's just kind of sparked off lots of different things. And the piece of footage that came from the kind of initial installation was put into a piece that allowed people to then ask questions that perhaps they had been looking for answers for. So, for example, I set the video into a TV on the set of metal drawers that had different questions posed on them. So there were questions like something you've always wanted to tell somebody, something that remains unsaid. So it was a set of sort of five questions that people could watch the footage and then anonymously fill in what they felt they maybe wanted to kind of offload. And that brought back that had some really interesting responses. People kind of quite angry with ex-lovers and sad over people who died that they hadn't a chance to say things to. And so at the moment, that piece of work is actually kind of locked in my garage because I'm not 100% sure where to go with that particular piece of work, because the pieces of information seem to be so fragile and gentle that I feel that they need something else, something a bit more reverential to kind of happen with that information, and I haven't quite decided what that is yet. So that's as far as that particular area has gone. But the Professor Morticia Catherine bit has kind of come out. She's come out a bit of the other side and said, "Hey, this looks like fun. Let's play on the plinth for a bit and kind of see what happens."
Had you used another character or persona before in your performance?
To a certain extent, when I first did my training, I trained as an actor, or an actress, but as an actor. So to a certain extent, I was always used to, I suppose, donning on those different roles, but nothing quite as nothing quite as deliberate, and perhaps as open as well, because obviously there is a certain amount of me invested in her. I played around a little bit with a few performance characters in other work that I'd done, particularly when I was doing my MA. I kind of recreated a sort of female Elvis, and she wasn't Elvis, but she had these kind of Elvis tendencies and the costume that she refused to take off. I've played around with other characters before, but I think this one is probably, she's here for a little while. I mean, I partly because I also write erotic fiction under that name as well. And she's had some work published in that area. So it was a kind of a transition. She was the much more outgoing side, I think, the one that was, you know, that was capable of writing erotic fiction, the one that was able to get up there and ask people questions about kissing and what they like to do with their mouths and things. So for a while she's even got a couple of avatars out there in the kind of multi-gay online game playing world. She's even got a couple of characters in various games that I'm just playing out for a while to see what happens and to see what people's responses are to her as well. So we'll see where she goes. I might just put her to bed after a while, but.
Earlier on, you were talking about snogisms that you were going to share with the audience, or the people in the square, rather, tonight. Tell me a bit more about what those are.
They're just facts about kissing, really, and about mostly about kissing. So, for example, how many nerves it takes to kiss, that as opposed to touching with your fingertips. How you can, you know, how kissing creates endorphins and can make you feel very, as equivalent as to taking morphine, and make you feel very blissed out and very high. So they're kind of facts really. They're snog facts, I guess. And the idea is that hopefully that there is a through line that leads through to people doing some mouth exercises and physically warming up their mouths the same as you would with any other part of the body. And then hopefully people will find a partner and find somebody to have a kiss with, which would be nice.
Can you remember your first kiss?
Oh, yes. Yeah, I can. It was at a school disco when I was about 15, and I was always the girl who didn't get asked to dance and who was always left standing on the sidelines or bring on the violins, and all my friends were much more glamorous and much more kind of cooler than I was, and I can't remember this guy's second name actually, but his name was Martin, and we had this dance and then we had a kiss, which was my I had a kiss before then, but it wasn't a proper kiss like this one was. So yeah, I do remember that, and the French trip, that we were French exchange when I was I must have been about 13 then, so actually maybe the sort of, there was a bit of a testing the water beforehand where I had this was picked up by this French boy. Everybody kind of got a French boy, and my friends all thought he was hideously ugly, and I thought he was beautiful, but he probably wasn't really that active. And I can remember having a sort of a snog with him too. And I think probably I always never count that as my first proper kiss, because I was always a bit embarrassed and a bit kind of. I was really shy when I was younger, so it was the kind of the one that happened a bit later in front of all my mates that was, you know, that was the one I always liked to kind of think, yeah, that's the first one, as opposed to the one in the garage in the middle of France when I was like 13 in a dark corner next to the petrol cans. I don't like to remember that one so much.
You talked about your character, your persona, your professor. How would you describe yourself as a person?
It's quite interesting, because when I was asked to describe myself with the three words, one of the first words I used was anxious, because I suffer quite badly with anxiety. I actually suffer from anxiety disorder, so I suffer from panic attacks, and anxiety's been quite a horrible thing for me in the last sort of probably 15 years. So anxious is probably one way I would describe myself. I talk too much. I always think I talk too much. I'm one of those people that sort of never knows when to stop a conversation. I had a conversation with the guy who's come to measure up my kitchen today, and I couldn't end this conversation no matter how hard I tried. I just wanted him to say, right, I'm going now. And I just kind of kept looking at him. And I thought, oh, I bet you just really want to leave, don't you? So I feel like I talk too much. So talkative, I guess. And short, because I'm quite short too. And impatient. I'm very impatient. And I've got quite a bad temper. I'm quite quick to temper, and I don't suffer from rage, but I'm quite protective over my children. So if anybody kind of gets on the wrong side of me, I tend to bark and kind of not lash out physically, but with my tongue, I sort of lash out a bit. So yeah, I wouldn't say I was entirely comfortable with myself. I think I probably don't like myself as much as I would like to. I guess it's something I'm learning as I go along. But then I guess perhaps everybody's like that, really. You perceive yourself in a kind of different way.
And how do you combat your anxiety?
Generally, I just try... I mean, sometimes it's really quite debilitating, but I've always tried to fight through it. So even if I've really suffered really badly with it, I've always tried to still do the thing I plan to do. Sometimes it's meant I haven't particularly enjoyed that thing I've done. I've come away thinking, well, I did it, but I may not necessarily have enjoyed it. And other times, you know, I can just ride through it, and actually it's great, because I feel like I've really achieved something by kind of battling it out. I try to do simple things like yoga and swimming and relaxing, try to relax, but it is difficult. And for anybody who suffers from anxiety, it's one of those things that we kind of give lip service to, and we say, I suffer from anxiety, but I think those people that do suffer properly with anxiety, that have anxiety disorders, it can be the most the most horrific and debilitating condition. I think there have been times when I have felt that if this is it, if this is all there is, then this is pretty miserable. I don't really want to kind of suffer from anxiety for the rest of my life. But I think at 43, perhaps I'm going to have to accept I'm going to have it to a certain extent, probably for good now.
Does it come out of the blue, or is it situational, do you think?
For me, it's a blessing and a curse, because I think without it, I probably wouldn't write the kind of things that I write as a writer, not necessarily as my kind of performance persona, but as a writer myself. I probably wouldn't write the kind of things that I write. I perhaps wouldn't be as creative as I feel that I am, and perhaps I wouldn't be as driven at times to do the things I do. But other times it's very difficult, because it stops me from doing things at times. I can feel very, traveling can often be quite difficult, or going abroad, or even going on holiday, or sometimes even day-to-day things, even if it's really bad, sometimes even kind of, you know, managing trips at work or anything like that can be difficult. So it is a blessing. It's a blessing and a curse all at the same time.
Carry on. Do you think there's a link somehow between this creativity?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. I mean, I think I would probably always. I think the two things go hand in hand. I think I probably would have one without the other. But equally so, if I didn't have anxiety, I probably wouldn't have the creativity, and the creativity in itself sometimes breeds anxiety, because it brings with it that sense of. It brings with it that sense of not wanting to be looked at, but not wanting to be looked at, and not wanting to be scrutinized, because sometimes scrutiny, you know, when you suffer from anxiety, the last thing you want is for somebody to scrutinize you. But obviously you put yourself up for that when you create anything, when you put anything up in that field. So I think it's a catch-22 situation. I think I could perhaps never ever put myself up for anything, and never put myself forward or put my work forward, but then I would also probably be spending a great portion of my time wishing that I was doing work and putting work together. But I'd like to do more work about anxiety, and I'd like to kind of explore that a little bit more, and kind of maybe at some point think of, you know, putting a project together that may be at the heart of it, because I think it's linked to, for me personally, it's linked to so many things. Somebody once said to me, you know, that the problem is with anxiety is that you can often, as an astute person, you can often work out where the root source of your anxiety is, but that doesn't mean you can actually deal with it. You might know where it's come from, but actually that doesn't stop it being that actually knowing what causes it is one thing, but it doesn't necessarily make it go away. And I guess that's kind of the point I'm at is that yeah, I know exactly where it's come from and how I've got to it from the many things that have happened in my life, but it doesn't necessarily mean that I actually can make it vanish. You know, it's not as easy as that.
So how do you feel about being watched on plinth? Is that a problem?
No, not at all. Because my anxiety manifests itself in very different ways. And also, you know, this is, to a certain extent, this is what I've chosen to do. You know, I put myself on display all the time to a certain extent. But even at work, you know, when I'm lecturing students, I'm on display. I'm sure there's that a lot of the students I have are between 16 and 18. I'm sure they have many things to point out, you know, about me, whether it's, you know, my hair, or they don't like the colour of my hair, or they, you know, they think that my teaching, you know, my teaching is too slow, or whatever, or not very interesting. So to a certain extent, I've kind of got over that audience anxiety. I don't suffer from audience anxiety. it's a slightly more complex animal than that.
So you've done quite a lot of one-to-one type work with people, from what you were saying about the kissing and people send you things anonymously.
Yeah.
Is that a route that you're wanting to pursue further?
I quite like the idea of creating kind of intimate performance. I quite like the idea of small audiences or singular audiences, or you know, people being able to have something which they can, an experience they can take away with them. And I really like the idea of people being able to take away something that makes them feel good, whether that is a chance to just kind of put their head on your shoulder for 5 minutes, or whether it's just because they want to tell you a secret that they've never told anybody, or just because they want, you know, to sit and hold your hand for 5 minutes. I like the idea of somebody being able to go away and feel better about themselves. I used to kind of be really interested in the kind of work that kind of makes people unsettled and uncomfortable, and kind of creates that sense of unease. And maybe that's because when I suffer from anxiety, that is exactly kind of the feeling I have. But actually, as I've got older, I feel like I'd like to do the opposite. And I kind of feel that I'd like to create a much more nurturing kind of performance environment. I like the idea of tea parties that people can come to. I also like the idea of women-only performance as well. I do practice. I'm actually a practicing pagan, and I do a lot of ritual work. And I like to work with just women, and that's not because my sexuality dictates that. Because I'm actually heterosexual, and I have a partner, and it's just that I like that sense of female energy, and that it makes me feel quite comfortable, and I quite like working in that environment. So I like the idea of creating some kind of women only performance as well.
Is there anything else you'd like to say?
No, just thank you for having me.
Thank you very much.